I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, it was 6 months ago that the regime of Syria's then-president Bashar al-Assad came crashing down. And now his machinery of torture and death that he used to retain power is starting to come out into the open. Syria's entire security apparatus was used to crush protests and anyone that spoke out against Assad. Frontline PBS investigates how the survivors are trying to move on, but still they cry out for justice. And later on The Source, San Antonio's AIDS Foundation has suspended free testing services due to the White House-imposed cuts at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. How can San Antonians still get tested safely and confidentially for AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In the second half hour, we're going to be hearing about the loss of federal funding for local HIV/AIDS testing and what that means for San Antonio public health. But first, a regime that crushed protesters by using brute force, fear, torture, and murder. That's how the then president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, held on to power. 6 months ago, though, he was ousted after a revolution, and now the secrets of his machinery of torture and murder are coming to light. The extent of the brutality is staggering. The numbers are numbing. Many are calling for justice, but before you can have accountability, you have to have an accounting and documentation, and we're getting that now. Tonight on PBS Frontline, the documentary airs Serious Detainee Files, and we're joined by the co-directors Sasha Jolie Akili and also Sarah Obadat. And welcome to The Source, Sasha and Sarah.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much.
Sasha, you not only interview people who survived the torture and the brutality, but also people who perpetrated the torturers. You're able to talk to them, and that is astonishing what we heard from them. Can you talk about what it was like to sit down with them? I guess, Sarah, I think you did the actual one-on-one interviews with them. What was it like to talk to them and hear their rationalization for the torture?
Yeah, so when we started tracking these men down, it took a really long time. And obviously, they needed to trust us as well in order to start to open up. And they were very, very nervous. And a lot of them at the time, sometimes it was frustrating because they would speak, trying to distance themselves from the actions of the regime, talk about things that they'd seen, but never really talk about the things that they took part in. And I think the most staggering interview for us was when we found this prison guard who worked at Sudnaya, and Sara sat down with him, and he started to really open up about the crimes that he had taken part in. And we were shocked.
And Sarah, what was that like?
I mean, I think it was was a lot of things. He was not by any means the first interview we had done. And as Sasha said, we sat down with a lot of other men before. And as you would expect, when you try to talk to people involved in an institution that's committed mass brutality, you'll get a lot of people that say, this is what happened, but I didn't have anything to do with it. Let me tell you what I saw. Let me tell you what I heard. But no, that wasn't me. Or we got a lot of, I was just, I had to do what I had to do. So finally, when we sat down with the prison guard, I think, firstly, I mean, neither of us were expecting it. And I think I found it actually a huge responsibility, because I could tell that he was, for the first time, telling me these things, reliving them and admitting them. And it almost felt like, I mean, he said, I had never told my family. my wife doesn't know much mm-hmm. about this. I've only given her, you know, the headlines. And so it felt like a huge privilege on the one hand to be able to get this testimony that was at that time very rare and very much in the public interest when the regime was still in power, but also at the same time quite harrowing because he was describing some really difficult things like executions.
Yeah.
Sasha, when a nation goes through something like this, and if Syria is not unique, a lot of countries have gone through disappearing people and torturing people and doing this to, you know, put down, you know, dissent. The question is, how do you come back from that? How do you recover? How do you heal from that? And is that what's happening now in Syria? Are people trying to figure out how to move forward?
I think it's very much, yeah, they're trying to figure it out. I don't think there is a clear answer to what that pathway looks like. You know, the two brothers we interview for our film, Shadi Harun and Hadi, they are a unique case. They, you know, right off the bat, leaving prison, started working for a Syrian organization who document the stories of prisoners, of former prisoners. They also try to track down the whereabouts of missing people. And they have made it kind of their mission to try to gather evidence of the crimes committed by the Assad regime and try to locate the missing. And what we realize is that the issue of the disappeared for a lot of Syrians, what Syrians have told us, is one of the biggest and most pressing issues. And until people get answers as to where people have gone, where they are buried, it'll be really hard for them to move on.
And Sarah, typically there's a denialism that comes in. People say it wasn't that bad or wasn't as tough as they say it was. So do you think the work that you're doing in telling these stories and providing the documentation and making it accessible to people, that's critical in order so we know there will be people who will deny this actually happened?
I mean, I think so. I'll try to answer your question in two parts. I mean, in we made this film partly in order for people to talk about this and to spark conversation and to document what's happened. We were also making it back when the regime was denying that there were any missing people. Mm-hmm. The regime used to say it had no missing people in the first place, right? So definitely this is like our effort to document this, we hope, you know, is part of this broader effort. But I do have to say, Syrian civil society for a very long time, from the start of the uprising, has been quite exceptional, actually, mm-hmm. when it comes to documenting the crimes of the Assad regime. You know, Sasha and I were actually quite taken aback by how many organizations were documenting the disappeared in different prisons or in mm-hmm. different areas. And so I think at this time, now that the regime has gone, it's going to be very difficult to deny that those things actually happened. And I will say, it was very hard for us to speak to any family mm-hmm. in Syria who does not have either a missing person or know a missing person.
Yeah.
Or know someone who was picked up in jail. This has become a societal issue, and very much something that is at the forefront of their minds.
So, I mean, obviously, Syria has gone through a lot. You know, Assad gassed his own people and did all sorts of terrible things. To trauma, how would they be processing that trauma, Sarah?
I mean, as you say, it has a long way to go, right? I mean, Syria has been, in a lot of ways, there are areas that have been completely destroyed. I mean, Shadi and Hadi's neighborhood, Saqba, which is just on a suburb of Damascus. If you just leave Damascus and go out 10, 15 minutes, you will see complete neighborhoods that look like ghost towns. And obviously, people are out of work. It's been economically very difficult. So I think, you know, the country has a long way to go in terms of rebuilding and trying to secure some of the basic needs, and then also trying to heal psychologically.
Yeah, right. And right now, Syria is getting ready to rejoin the global economy. But we're going to talk more about the brothers that you interviewed and their story, and about how a system of brutality becomes almost like fights for its own survival, and how that becomes a threat. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Syria's detainee files was commissioned by the BBC Current Affairs for the award-winning This World series, and it will air tonight, a co-production of Frontline PBS, and you can tune in. But I do have to warn you, there are some extremely brutal images and descriptions of torture. We're speaking to the two co-directors of this incredible film. You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Sasha, you didn't go into detail about the types of torture that people had to endure, and I appreciate that. I didn't need to know, but we do see some incredible images of dead bodies. And how did you process that this needed to be seen?
Yeah, so, I mean, those images were images that were leaked back in 2013. They were taken out of Syria by a really famous defector and whistleblower that was nicknamed Caesar. And he brought out these images as evidence of the torture and the executions that were taking place inside the intelligence branches and inside Syria's prisons. And also evidence of the documentation that was actually taking place. So despite people going missing, there was clear evidence that the regime was keeping files, the detainees' files, on everybody who passed through their institutions. And those images we felt were important to show in a part of the film in which we talk about the role that the military hospitals played in concealing the facts of the crimes that were being committed by the regime. And military hospitals often needed to registered deaths that had clearly people who had died due to torture or disease or sometimes executions, but the cause of death was always just written as heart and respiratory failure.
Yeah, I wondered about that. Why go through that deception? Why need to lie about that? Was that facade important for maintaining the Assad regime, Asara?
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, they documented everything. And at the end of the day, I mean, look, this was obviously a brutal system and a dictatorship, but it was also a functioning country and a bureaucracy. And they did need to document, they did need to sort of be in some ways accountable for who has been deceased, right? Because if you don't register these deaths, you have problems later on when it comes to things like land distribution, inheritance, documents. I mean, it opens up a can of worms. So it's a bit of a mundane answer, but really, I mean, they needed to document this because this is what you have to do in a country with a bureaucracy. They need to cover up their crimes.
Yeah.
And so the military hospitals were complicit in assisting the security services in covering up the fact that there was torture by obfuscating the reasons for death.
So Assad just wanted to present the image to the world that he was just a happy-go-lucky bureaucrat and that he really had no control over this apparatus. And did people buy that?
I don't think the international community bought that pretty early on. And the reason I think that they didn't is because, the brutality didn't start with Bashar al-Assad. The Assad regime has been there for almost 50 years. And it started with his father. And Syria was known back in the day, even before the uprising, to be very much a police state. It was very much kind of taken for granted that you shouldn't be speaking out against the government, even if you're a tourist or a visitor, right? And they had committed massacres as early as the 80s and kind of have never been held accountable. So I think the international community never really bought that. And I think, you know, the Syrian uprising was led by Syrians who were, many of whom were incredibly educated, were documenting this, were filming this on social media.
And a lot of the generals who were carrying these things out and were, you know, running the prisons, and a general that Shadi, our main character, actually encounters, and so does his brother, called Jamil Hassan, for example, was a general who worked under Bashar's father and had carried out brutalities back in the 80s. And so it was this culture that kind of continued and persisted when the uprising began.
So you mentioned the brothers, Sadi and Hadi. The bravery that they show is incredible. One of the brothers, was it Shadi, who was first taken into detainment and then he was released, and he goes back to protesting again, even though he had first-hand account on how terrible that experience would be. He put his life on the line in order to do those protests. I mean, the amount of bravery that must have taken is incredible. So, Sarah, can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you meet Shadi, you realize that he's an incredibly principled person who has, you know, who believes very much in... He lives his life very much in a code of ethics that he really, really adheres to. And the biggest testament to that is after almost a decade in prison, he goes and works at an organization that's documenting missing detainees and documenting the plight of detainees. And he is exposing himself every day to trauma that he and his brother went through. Mm-hmm. But he understands that this is important. Shadi is very much a symbol of the early protest movement in Syria. People who went to the streets because they believed in democracy and they believed in, you know, anti-corruption, and they wanted the population to be represented. And so I think part of the bravery comes from that. He's also incredibly stubborn. I mean, yes. I can say
sometimes. I mean, there were some, you know, stories. Obviously, not everything is in the film. And we interviewed him for maybe 25 hours in total. So a lot of stories where, you know, he comes face to face with horrible generals and he's standing up to them saying, you know, you have your ideology, I have mine, and only one will win. And, you know, this is after he's been tortured, and yet he's still speaking his mind. So
I'm going to go to a caller. We have Jose. And Jose, you're on the air. Go right ahead.
Hi. First, I'd like to challenge one of the myths that you just pawned off. The Syrian government did not gas its own people. That's under serious dispute with the OPCW. All right. That's number one. Number two is that the Syrian people, in their revolution, all right, and their fight against the Assad regime, that fight, that revolution was backed by our NGOs who were funded by the National Endowment for Democracy, which is a CIA front. And we're well aware there's so much documentation on this.
Okay.
All right.
So, Jose, thank you for the call, and I'm going to get their response. So, Sarah, do you want to take that on?
I mean, I'll just respond very quickly by saying there is plenty of available evidence that strongly suggests that the Syrian government, used its own mortars and sometimes warplanes to release a nerve agent, basically killing its own people. This happened in Khan Sheikhoun in 2017. It also happened in 2013 in Eastern Ghouta, where Shadi was from. I think it's just pretty thoroughly documented. So I'm not sure I want to like get into that per se. But in terms of the uprising that happened, I mean, we can talk about how it started, and then we can talk about then the actors outside that decided to also involve themselves on this. What started in 2011, early days, you know, when the days where Shadi is talking about his participation, was very much a protest movement led by Syrians trying to take into their own hands the future of their country. What happens later by the involvement of other actors and funding proxies per se is something that, you know, we can't deny, but it does not delegitimize the cause that, that Syrians took to the streets for.
Sasha, is it 1 million people may have been detained? Is that number correct?
Over 1 million people were detained during the civil war at some point, and not everybody was detained necessarily for 10 years. Some people were arbitrarily arrested and then released shortly afterwards. So these are the numbers of people who passed through the prisons at some point during the uprising and then the civil war.
And about how many were killed after detainment?
These numbers are really hard to determine. What we can say is that there are over 100,000 people that are still missing. And then in terms of people killed in prison or due to torture, those numbers are really hard to come by.
I think numbers are going to become much clearer in the coming years once people have had the chance to go through the trove of evidence that's been left by the regime.
And dig up mass graves.
Yeah.
So the interesting thing, so we had everyone basically saying, I was just doing my job. If I didn't do it, I would have been killed myself. I would have been in on the other side of the detainment. I would have been the one being tortured if I didn't do it. And so it's interesting to me how the whole apparatus, the machinery of the torture and the murder becomes a self-sustaining system. And that's the scary part of it all, how difficult and how that can happen basically anywhere. So, Sasha, I'd like to get your take on that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this was a vast system, and the Ba'athist state was very much in, you know, the Ba'athist party, which was Hafez al-Assad's and Bashar al-Assad's political party, was pervasive in the whole of society. And children grow up reading books and being
indoctrinated
into believing that the Ba'athist party is the only way of living, that Hafez al-Assad is like a god and Bashar al-Assad after him. And so a lot of people or young men potentially are very like proud to join the military. And then, you know, a lot of people, depending on where they grow up, come from rural areas. And it's not like there are many opportunities. So you either join the army, or if you have connections, you might join an intelligence agency. And that guarantees you a job. It guarantees you certain benefits. And so it's really hard to kind of choose and have different ways of living and choose a different path. And so some people kind of relied on this system and relied on these jobs as part of their survival. So in many ways, it doesn't mean to, decriminalize the actions of certain people who were like this middle tier group of people who carried out these actions. But you know, it's always important to look at everybody's story, where they're from, and why they ended up working for those institutions and continue to work for them.
Bashar al-Assad is in Russia now, living in luxury, although almost in a state of confinement under the Putin regime. Any chance, Sarah, that he will find some level of justice?
I think that's hard to say. I think only time will tell. But I think something else that we should keep in mind is, like, obviously, justice isn't just about trials. I mean, trials are very important. And as we've seen, you know, these things take years, sometimes decades, to happen. But they do. I mean, we've seen that happen for other conflicts. But we do have to remember that the regime has only, collapsed in the last 6 months. So it's still a long road ahead. And hopefully, what we'll see is also other efforts of justice for Syrians that'll happen inside the country as well. Things that can allow families of the missing to get the acknowledgement that they are seeking for what happened to them, more answers about the missing, more compensation. These are also the kinds of things Syrians are calling for when it comes to justice.
Co-directors of the PBS Frontline documentary that airs tonight, Syria's Detainee Files, Sasha Joel Akili and Sarah Obidet, thank you so much for talking to us today. Congratulations on your film. It's fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you
for having us.
Thank you.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for hearing us today.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.